All right, you guys, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show.
Yo, Chuck, what's the move, man? I was on my way up here to the studio, you know what I'm saying? And this brother stopped me and asked me, yo, what's up with that brother, Chucky D? He sway nice. I said, yo, the brother don't sway nice. He knows he's nice, you know what I'm saying? So, Chuck, you gotta feel me. You turned him into a public enemy, man. Now, remember that line you was kicking to me on the way out to L.A. Lounge in Queens while we was in the car on the way to the shop? Well, yo, right now, kick to the bass for them brothers and let them know what goes on.
All right, you guys, welcome to the show. I am Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And hey, yesterday, Chuck D followed me on Twitter. So I almost went overboard and changed my logo to the point blank target and all that, but I thought I'd play a little PE on the show for you today. All right, so I got a good show lined up for today. Abdi Samatar is going to be here. Wrote about the Nairobi massacre and Al-Shabaab for Al Jazeera the other day, the Nairobi massacre. And, you know, apologies, I'm quite a few weeks behind on that story, though. I'm glad I'm finally going to have someone on to cover that. And then also Doug Bandow is going to be on the show to talk about the Lusitania, Woodrow Wilson. It was 100 years ago today that Churchill successfully arranged for it to be sunk by the Germans. Yeah, they're always lying you into war, these liars. And anyway, so, yeah, man, Bandow's got a really good one about that in Forbes. Love Bandow, dude. So Bandow's going to be on to talk about Darth Wilson and his highest treason. How he ruined everything for everyone forever. So that'd be cool. And then plus, I got a ton of news. Tons and tons of news. So, yeah, I'm Scott Horton, scotthorton.org. So now, it's not exactly a false flag. I mean, it was the Germans that sank the boat. It was just that Churchill set him up to be sank. So, kind of, hey, that's where the term blind eye comes from in the first place, isn't it? English Channel? All right, so check it out. Will Porter has a new one at antiwar.com. The Empire Comes Home. And hey, that's why it's the Randolph Bourne Foundation. Randolph Bourne is not some billionaire that donated a bunch of money for there to be an antiwar.com. I promise. He was a penniless anarchist who died back, 100 years ago. And he was a classical liberal anarchist type. And he wrote the great essay, The State. And he never even finished it, actually, because he died of the flu, which you could call the Woodrow Wilson flu, because it was already kind of breaking out, and then he put a whole bunch of guys on ships together in close confines for weeks and weeks on end and helped to incubate a complete and horrible catastrophe. And anyway, so Randolph Bourne, he wrote this great thing, War is the Health of the State. It's it will inform your perspective. It's not just the title. I mean, the title is obvious, right? Assuming that your state doesn't lose and is not completely defeated, then war is good for its power over you. James Madison could have told you that. Everybody knows that. But It's really good, man, the way he explores the issue. And Dan Sanchez, actually, our newest regular contributor at antiwar.com. He's also the teacher of the Mises Academy at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He had a great one that's kind of a review of Born and kind of, you know, what Dan learned reading Born. It's not just that war is the health of the government. It's the corruption of the people in so many ways. And so, anyway, Will Porter has a great one along these lines at antiwar.com today. The Empire Comes Home. And it's about the militarization of the police, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe you've read quite a few like this, but I think you'll like this one. I think you might enjoy passing it around to all of your friends on the Facebook. Hey, look, everybody, you want to know why America's a police state? Because our government wages a world empire. And because there's no such thing, never has been, never will be, such a thing as a limited constitutional world empire. You either got militarism or you don't. War is the health of the state. So there you go. The Empire Comes Home. It's a good one by Will Porter. And now here's the other kind of flip side of that. And I think this is really important. I've talked about this on the show in the past, too, although maybe not enough. This article's in the Washington Post. It's not like he did a lot of work for it or anything. He's just quoting from Reddit, basically. But still, there's an important lesson in it. These cops are tired of white people getting freaked out by their black neighbors. That's the headline. And it's about how black people just get the cops called on them all day long for nothing all the time. And you already knew that was true, but here's a bunch of great anecdotes. And it's not the black people complaining about it. It's the cops complaining about it. It's the white cops saying to the white civilian populace, hey, you know, toughen up a little bit. You know, this guy, what was so suspicious about these guys? Well, they were trying to jumpstart a car at 9:30 in the morning. That's a pretty suspicious thing to do. And the thing of it is, this is worse and more widespread and more evil than you think or is portrayed in this article. This is just kind of scraping the surface. I mean, that's really the truth of it is, as George Carlin said, a friend sent me on Twitter this morning, George Carlin, the best version I've ever heard of George Carlin ranting about America becoming a population of rats and squealers and anonymous tip line leavers and all this kind of thing. And I've told this story before on the show, but it's probably been quite a while. So many of you may not have heard it, but back when I was a cab driver, I used to take, in fact, just a couple of times, I guess, I took this lady, I think the same lady, it's been a while. I'm trying to remember exactly, but yeah, it's the same lady a couple of times, I think. I took her down to the police station because she was the 911 operator, little old black lady. And that was what she told me, was that all day long, the phone just rings off the hook. Well, I'm afraid because of whatever. And the way she categorized it, and I don't know if she was keeping count or just going off the top of her head, but she was saying, let's see, I always suck at math and screw the numbers up. I think what she was saying was 5% of the calls are legit emergencies. We need an ambulance or there's an armed robbery in progress, and so we need cops. There is something, you know, the guy's beating his wife to death next door, and we're, you know, her screams are getting quieter and quieter, please hurry, kind of thing. These kind of legit emergencies, 5%. 5% of the calls. Then about 15% of the calls were actual government business, but not emergencies, right? Like, you know, I don't know, man. Calling to ask when's the policeman's ball or whatever the crap, right? Legit calls to the police, but nothing in the way of there's a crisis that must be solved right now at all. And then, so that's 15% of them. And then, which you can count those as basically, you know, worthless, wrong number calls, more or less. And then the other 80% were people just calling to get, either because they're afraid of nothing or they're calling just to get each other in trouble. My neighbor borrowed my wheelbarrow and he brought it back a little bit bent and didn't say sorry. And so I'm calling to tell on him because his grass is too long. And this kind of crap all day long. Because Americans hate freedom. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Like I say, coming up, Abdi Samatar on America's destruction of Somalia. Doug Bandow on America's destruction of the whole wide world. Anyway, that's not an overstatement. It sounds like it might be, but it's not. That's what's fun about it. Yeah, that Woodrow Wilson. All right. So, I'm sorry. Let me say real quick, the brakes always interrupt me. The 911 calls thing. America's a nation of rats. And it's not just white people that do it. It's all kinds of different people that do it. That what happens is, I know exactly what happens in your mind as you do it. Not necessarily you, but one does this. There's a thing that I don't like and I want it to be solved for me. And so, blam, call 911. So we're all conditioned to do that. And hardly anyone objects to that kind of way of thinking or way of life. And then don't you see the socialist moral hazard that's built in? You know, the nosy neighbor that lives across the street from Bewitched, she can just call 911 all day. It doesn't cost her anything. If she had to pay for her own drug raids against her neighbors who she thinks has too many friends over sometimes or whatever, and she had to actually pay for that out of her own retirement, and maybe she'd mind her own business a little bit. That's one of the examples from the Washington Post story, where the new white people move into the neighborhood and immediately start calling the cops on all of their neighbors. Well, they got friends over all the time. I think they're dealing drugs. You know what? What if they are? What if they have a drug business? What's it to you? For God's sake, man. And, you know, back when I was on Facebook, I would post article after article after article of cops murdering people. And this has been going on for a long, long time, of course. Cops showing up murdering people over nothing, and including at least one case where literally they were called over the neighbor's stereo was too loud. And that was why they showed up and killed somebody. And then later I saw one of my Facebook friends said, that, yeah, you know, Scott Horton finally beat it into my thick skull that when the neighbor kids, and he was a father, you know, had children and stuff, I was saying, when the neighbor kids are playing their music too loud in the middle of the night and my first instinct is to reach over and call the police, I don't do that anymore. I go ahead and get up out of bed and go over and talk to him and ask him nicely, because that was his first instinct. And this guy's a real hippie too, man. Great guy. I'm not talking bad about him, but I'm just saying he's an American. He's raised on this culture. Even a hippie like him, his first instinct is to call the Nazi Gestapo stormtroopers of death to come and make his neighbors turn their damn music down. And the only thing that could get through to him to make him, you know, snap out of it and stop thinking that way and acting that way was me at my most extreme posting article after article after article saying, see, they're Nazis. See, they're the Gestapo. See, look at this no-knock raid where they killed this woman. See, over and over and over and over, and finally he realized, whoa, I'm part of the problem. I'm the demand for their supply. I've got to quit calling the cops on my neighbors. But it was like, he had to climb a mountain to get there. Right? His first instinct is to be a rat. To join up the tips program. See, if you see something, say something. If something bothers you, call the cops on them. It, whoever, whatever. It's crazy. And, you know, according to George Carlin, who was old, he said America didn't used to be like that. But now it is. And it certainly is now. Oh, and by the way, speaking of Public Enemy, what's your top five? Because I got to say, you know, I'd like to say Public Enemy's one, but Public Enemy's two. For me, Beasties have got to be one. And then Public Enemy, Immortal Technique, Gangstar, EPMD. Although, EPMD could probably switch out with KRS-One or Eric B. and Rakim. But, yeah, definitely Beasties and Public Enemy 1 and 2 since 1986. No doubt about that. Okay, so, yeah, now check this out. What two programmers have revealed so far about Seattle police officers who are still in uniform? So, you know how they always say, oh, well, it's under investigation, so we can't comment. Well, they got around that. There was a court ruling or a new law passed or something in Washington State that says that all these internal affairs documents are open public records and can be sued for. And these two, you know, upper middle class white computer programmers have decided that they are going to use their advantages to sue for all the records that they can get. And what they found is, guess what? The police in Seattle, they're criminals. They're criminals. And they got the goods on them big time here. All kinds of abuse of authority. Just like, I mean, nothing out of the ordinary, but exactly what you would imagine if you're pissed off and imagining the worst. It's thestranger.com. Thestranger.com. And they got this great article. What two programmers have revealed so far about Seattle police officers who are still in uniform, and they're still getting the work done. And I hope this article and whatever coverage they get from it will help rally allies to their side, because I believe they need help and are far from done there. So great project for you to look into. And thanks, Bob, for the link this morning. And then this one is scary as hell, man. Again, with the moral hazard here. Whistleblowers reveal CPS child kidnappings in Kentucky adoption business. And this is at Health Impact News is the blog entry. But all they do is they embed the YouTubes from the local news channel here, right? So it's in case you desperately need that or whatever. This is mainstream media coverage from the local TV news channel here, wherever the hell it is in Kentucky. And they got a ton of whistleblowers proving all of this. And you know what it is, right? It's just the simple economics of being cops. They get paid more for taking more children, so they do it. And I know you would think that, come on, they're not going to do that. They're not going to separate children from their parents just because, hey, we got to keep our numbers up. Yes, they will. That's how they get their money. That's how the local and state governments get the federal money. Is by proving to the feds the enormous numbers of families they're breaking up. And then, of course, there's corruption all around it, where you have the foster families even picking out the families whose kids they want, and then sending the bureaucrats to go. This is how perverse the incentives have been allowed to get. I think those kids should be separated from their parents. Why don't you go and break up their family and give their kids to me? What? I mean, I'm telling you, it's like a Terry Gilliam flick or something going on here. You got to look at this. It's crazy. It's, you know what it is? It's exactly what a libertarian would explain to you is how it works. It's public choice theory. What do government bureaucrats do? Love your own kids more than you? No. They're individuals. They look out for their own interests and the interests of their friends and coworkers, just like everybody else. So how do they keep the racket going? By keeping the racket going. It's just as simple as that. You don't have to be a German Nazi or Soviet communist to act just like one. Look at this. Seriously, man. It'll blow your mind. HealthImpactNews.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, sorry to bury the lead. Here's the top story of the day. Appeals court, ow, god dang, man. I bit the inside of my cheek, you know. I do that sometimes. I am too good at talking. I need some practice talking. Appeals court rules NSA phone program not authorized by Patriot Act. You don't say. ACLU lawsuit argued the data collection should be stopped because it violates Americans' privacy rights. So, two parts of the suit. They said, one, Patriot Act Section 215 does not legalize this, Your Honor. And two, Your Honor. Isn't that funny? You're supposed to call judges Your Honor. Like they're just automatically honorable just because they work for the government. We should call them all Your Honor, you know? At the DMV and the local traffic cop. Yes, Your Honor. Whatever you say, Your Majesty. His Highness, that's how John Boehner introduced Benjamin Netanyahu when he gave his speech to the Congress there. No, I swear to God, go look. It's on YouTube. Oh, no, it was His Excellency, not His Highness. His Excellency. All right, I swear to God and I was wrong, but I was close. And I'm an atheist, so I'm sorry. Anyway. So they said, hey, Patriot Act 215 does not legalize this program, and the Fourth Amendment makes this law null and void anyway. The government has no authority to pass a law that violates the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment forbids anything like this. Any kind of general warrant is obviously illegitimate. And the court said, well, never mind the Fourth Amendment. We don't even need to get that far because you're right. That it would just be insane to pretend that the word relevant to a terrorism investigation goes so far as to include every telephone record in the country. It just doesn't. Somehow, somewhere, even in the American federal court system, words have to mean things. And as long as they had their secret, oh, and this is what the court said. As long as they had their secret interpretation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, they could pretend that this was legit. But ever since Edward Snowden liberated the NSA documents and had Glenn Greenwald publish them in The Guardian and other places, now that we know that this is what they're doing with the Patriot Act, this is what the secrecy of their interpretation is meant to cover. That their interpretation is obvious, bogus, nonsense. And you know who could have told you that? James Sensenbrenner, the congressman who helped to write the Patriot Act and introduce it in the House of Representatives. He said, what? 215? That doesn't authorize this. I wrote it, and I'm telling you. But now here's what they didn't do. They didn't order the NSA to stop. Because they said the Patriot Act is up for review right now, which it is. It's up for sunset, where the Congress would have to reauthorize this part of the Patriot Act. Not the whole thing, but this part of it is sunsetting. And so we'll have to wait and see what the legislators do. And then depending on that, come back and see us, the court ruled. And so it could be, I don't know what's going to happen. I will give credit to Rand Paul, as he's been good on this, and he, I think, is actually doing work in the Senate to help end this mass surveillance under Section 215. Now, of course, they can just move the program over to Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, and then if that doesn't work, they'll just invoke Executive Order 12333, or they'll just break the law and do whatever they want anyway, because who's going to stop them? You? Anyway, that's their attitude. So I'm not saying that this is everything, but what it is it's proof that what Edward Snowden did was the right thing. Here's the Federal Appeals Court agreeing with Snowden that, whoa, this is a crime, and it's ongoing, and nobody's stopping it, and I have to tell the American people about this, because in America, the people are sovereign, and they allow the government to exist, to be their security force, to protect their rights. And in America, the government doesn't have the authority to violate our rights. Not without due process of law, they don't. And due process of law and a ban against unreasonable searches would preclude things like general warrants for everybody's telephone data. All the time. Okay, now two more important points along these lines. The USA Freedom Act is a giant hoax. As Marcy Wheeler has been way out ahead of everybody on this, and even, I don't know whether she succeeded, but she's certainly attempted to check the ACLU and the EFF and say, you guys are messing up getting behind this American Freedom Act, the USA Freedom Act. It's just like the Patriot Act. It's, you know, call it one thing when really it's another. And in fact, wasn't it Sensenbrenner who had started the thing to fix what they were doing to his Patriot Act legislatively, taking it way beyond as bad as it already was? But then they ended up adding a bunch of amendments and ruining it and making it worse in the U.S. Senate. And so, anyway, Marcy has shown why what this will do is it'll just help solidify. It'll be like the FISA Amendments Act, only even worse, and it'll help solidify the permanence of the so-called bulk collection. Obviously, a better term would be mass surveillance. Ron Paul also recently wrote an article against this, too. You can find it at antiwar.com. And then check this out. The computers are listening. Now, I had an invite out. I was hoping to get this guy on the show. It's Dan Frumkin at The Intercept. The computers are listening. How the NSA converts spoken words into searchable text. Oh, man, I need that so bad, guys. I mean, there's Dragon and everything, but it doesn't seem like that good. Oops. I can't get it to work good enough, I guess. Maybe I need somebody who took a class in that thing to really make it go for me. I don't know. The documents show NSA analysts celebrating the development of what they called Google for Voice nearly a decade ago. Oh, my God, you're killing me. I mean, this is horrible when it comes to spying, but can you imagine if you could just search all of my radio archives and especially my interview archives for keywords? Just search the MP3s for text. Automagic, built-in, good enough transcripts of everything. Wow. Oh, well, anyway, so no, they're doing it to persecute us and violate our rights and make us slaves. Destroy America forever. But wow, isn't that cool? I guess soon enough they'll have that. You know, Google will be able to search MP3s for spoken words, right? How the hell long can that take with the computer power they got now, right? Are they past the i7s yet? Whatever the hell those are. The new badass chip. So there's your telephone spying, high-tech police state news for today. And you know what? Again, I'd like to recommend you to that great article at Tom Dispatch yesterday by Michael Alexander Gould-Wartofsky, where he really explains the high-tech crackdowns on peaceful protest. Very good stuff. And you can find it under Tom Englehart's name there at antiwar.com. That goes right in that same pile. And then, you know what? I forgot to even bother with this yesterday and the day before because, you know, I don't know. Who cares? Are you buying this? Or are we upset about this? The Garland shooting thing? Officials doubt ISIS connection in Texas attack. I did read that J.M. Berger, the expert at online jihadism, said that the one guy had been talking with Islamic State guys online on Twitter, but that doesn't really mean anything. And just because they take credit doesn't mean it was their attack. But it didn't have to be, right?
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. All right, lots to cover in a very short time before we get to the interviews today here. One more thing about this ISIS thing. I think one of the reasons people aren't making that big of a deal about it is because nobody likes Pamela Geller, or no one wants to go on the record really defending her. On the left, you see people saying, it's not free speech, it's hate speech. What? For Christ's sake. You know, what is the entire left? Just a bunch of tiny little children? Hate speech is protected, too. What if I hate you? You're going to outlaw me for that, you dumb, whiny, crybaby liberals? The Ku Klux Klan has a right to get together and talk about how much they hate whoever they feel like hating. Okay? And so does Pamela Geller, who's really nothing but a Klansman, only targeting different minorities. But the same difference. So, Pamela Geller is a piece of crap, and every word out of her mouth is horrifying and ridiculous and stupid and hateful and evil. But so what? Ridiculous, hateful, evil people get to say things too. Otherwise, how would you justify the speech of the center of America's two majority parties? They're all a bunch of violent, rhetoric-filled, hateful lawmongers and warmongers. So, yeah, hate speech protected in America. Sorry, I don't know why that's supposed to be some kind of dichotomy. It's not. And Pamela Geller has the right to do what she did, and the guys who tried to attack her rally had no right, of course, whatsoever to do it, although, of course, it still remains, as far as I'm concerned, an open question of why it is that they did what they did and who all influenced them to do it, etc. I mean, there are plenty of jerks in the world. You know, a Twitter friend of mine, fan of the show, sent me a thing the other day where this guy, he was a cop, too. He was in the, like, unarmed citizens on patrol thing only. No, step up from that. Step up from citizens on patrol, but, like, the ready reserve cops or whatever the hell in his town. He was an Air Force veteran going back into the Army. His girlfriend broke up with him, so he went to a bridge, and he just waxed two families. He just killed two families, this guy and his two little girls, and then some other lady, some other man, I forget. And, in fact, the cool part of the story was, as the guy was dying with his dead two daughters with him, and his wife was, you know, trying to escape with his other kid, his last words were, forgive this guy for what he did. Wow, dude. That's really something, huh? And that was my Twitter friend's friend that caught the bullet. And the guy that killed him, he's just some mass murderer. And they're mass murderers, man. Particularly cops love murdering people. So this guy's girlfriend didn't want to be his girlfriend anymore, and he decided he'd show her by waxing a bunch of innocent people on a nice spring evening. So, it's not like it takes an FBI informant to get some jerk to show up somewhere with a rifle and kill people, but seems like they like provoking these kinds of things as much as they can, so I wouldn't be surprised. And of course, Pamela Geller was doing her best to provoke such a thing. That was why she did it. It was funny. On conservative media, they were calling it an art contest. Yeah, whatever, guys. Anyway, whole thing's ridiculous. And yeah, it didn't need to be some kind of inside job when the whole point was to provoke somebody. And this kind of thing is going to keep happening. It just goes to show ISIS doesn't need to come here. It's that easy for some idiot to take a rifle and show up where there's a lot of people and kill them. In this case, security got the drop on their asses quick. And did you read this too? Where the SWAT showed up completely after the fact when the two guys were dead. And the SWAT guys just showed up and unloaded some rounds into their corpses too. And said, oh, well, they were afraid. They were afraid? Of two dead guys that the motorcycle cop, traffic cop, had already wasted? Anyway, hey, Omar Khadr's free to go. Within like an hour or something, he'll be out the door. The judge said he can go. They printed the quote in the star.com, the Toronto Star. Mr. Khadr, you are free to go. So he's out on bail. He may have to go back to prison someday, actually. But here's the story of Omar Khadr, okay? He was a 15-year-old kid with his dad in Afghanistan at the time of the American invasion in 2001. His dad left him with these guys. You stay here with these guys. And went and took off. Wherever he went. So Omar Khadr is at this compound, which is what you call a house when the Delta Force attacks it. And the Delta Force attacked it. And they killed everybody except for Omar Khadr, who was found, I believe, it's been a little while, but I'm pretty sure, shot twice, full of shrapnel, buried in rubble, unconscious, almost dead. And one of the Delta Force guys died. And they decided that they would charge Omar Khadr with war crimes and pin the death on him. There's no evidence. There's no indication. As Mohammed El-Baradei might say, there is no reason to believe. There's no reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe whatsoever that Omar Khadr killed this Delta Force fighter. They try to say, oh, he was a medic. Yeah, by profession, but he was carrying a gun and firing it in that battle. And so look at all the ways this breaks down. He's 15 years old, which means automatic immunity. He's a child soldier. That's the law. End of story. Then he's a civilian defending his house, or a civilian house where he's staying, from an attack by a foreign invading army. That's not a war crime. They accuse him of throwing a grenade and killing this guy, and there's no reason to believe he even did it. So it's double extra super not a war crime. Because it didn't even happen. And then they tortured him mercilessly. And they credibly threatened his family. You know, that's how hard and evil Americans are now. You say, yeah, they threatened to kill his mom. And people go, well, you know, it's not like they killed her. Oh, yeah, well, what if someone was torturing you and had you chained to a dungeon wall and was describing what they were going to do to your mom while you were there helpless, unable to protect her? That's the American-style torture. And they just beat the living crap out of this kid at Bagram and at Guantanamo Bay. And they ended up having him plead guilty to war crimes when he didn't do it. And what he supposedly did isn't even a war crime at all. And then they finally let him leave Guantanamo. And go to Canada, where he's been in prison for, I don't know, 2 years or something up there. And now finally he's out on bail. And so I don't know exactly the circumstance of that. What's he, awaiting a new trial or something? I don't know. But the government is appealing. He's out on bail. The government is appealing. But for now, apparently today, the appellate judge has said, you're free to go, at least for now. And you want to know all about this story, here's what you do. You go to YouTube. You can watch the whole thing on YouTube. It's called You Don't Like the Truth. And that's a quote from Omar Khadr, the child soldier victim of war crimes committed by Americans against him, talking to the Canadian interrogator. The Canadian interrogator comes and he goes, "Oh, thank God, a Canadian interrogator. Man, let me tell you exactly what's going on here, okay?" And he just starts spilling his whole guts and just telling every scrap of truth he can think to tell. "Let me tell you what's going on." And then all of a sudden he realizes, you don't like the truth. You don't want the truth. Oh, I get it. You're just like these Americans. You're trying to put all these crazy terrorist words in my mouth. You don't want me to tell you what's true. You're not here for any kind of check and balance on their power at all. You're here to do whatever your own thing is. It has nothing to do with treating me fairly whatsoever. I get it. Takes them about 30 seconds or something. You don't like the truth. And by the way, you can see the testimony of the monster. I forgot the guy's name. He's a real human being. But he had monster tattooed on his gigantic chest. It was one of these 300 pounds of all muscle, like log throwing competition built sort of humongous brutes. And his job was beating the living crap out of everybody at the Bagram prison. And he talked about the tortures that others put Cotter through. Although he claimed when it was on his shift, he protected him because he was just a boy. Anyway, look it up on YouTube. You Don't Like the Truth is what it's called, about Omar Khadr. And congratulations for his lawyer for getting him out, and for him for getting out finally.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next is Abdi Ismaili Samatar, a professor of geography at the University of Minnesota and a research fellow at the University of Pretoria. He is also the president of the African Studies Association. He's got this important article at aljazeera.com. It's called The Nairobi Massacre and the Genealogy of the Tragedy. Welcome to the show, Abdi. How are you doing?
Thank you, Scott. Pleasure to be with you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here on the show. And happy to have someone on who's fluent in this subject of the recent war and going back a decade in Somalia. So we got about basically two 10-minute segments. So is it okay if we start with, you know, I don't know, 2005, I guess, if you want, or in fact, maybe even the intervention leading up to the declaration of the Islamic Courts Union and then the Ethiopian invasion in response, and then we can get to more current subject matter.
Sure, that's fine with me.
Sure. Okay, so go ahead. So take us back to, I guess, if you want, the dawn of the war on terrorism or whenever you think is apt.
You know, I think the place to begin is 1991 when the country's government collapsed. And they never had a government covering the entire territory since 1991. There are factional leaders here and there. There are regimes here and there. But not a sort of a country, a government that controls its territory fully and that's accountable to its people. The failure of that government or the collapse of that government was induced by two forces. Local forces, Somalis themselves, and certain elements of the political elite in that country who wanted to use the state or the government for their own ends rather than for the serving the interest of the population. And the second force was the rivalry between what was then the Soviet Union and the United States. And so the Cold War put a lot of weaponry into that country, first by the Soviets and then by us later on. And so the people began to realize that nobody was serving their interests and began to move against the regime. And the regime brutalized people and killed hundreds of thousands of people for several years. Then the country collapses, and then warlords, as we know them, took over the country. And because some of the warlords were using food as a weapon against hapless people, so they caused a famine that killed 300,000 people. In 1992, President George Bush Sr. Couldn't, I guess, stomach the brutality of these warlords and send, I think, over 20,000 American forces to open up the road so that food aid can get to sort of hungry people. The project, narrowly defined to get the food to the people, was successful and averted what could have been even a worse catastrophe. But what our government and the military we had on the ground did not do is to help Somalis who were interested to put their country back together and produce a government that was accountable to its population. Then we had Black Hawk down, and we withdrew from that. And then for up to about 1997, we didn't pay much attention to the country. And then, of course, in 1997-98, our embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, were bombed by terrorists from Al-Qaeda. Some of those terrorists were said to have passed through Somalia to get to Kenya and Tanzania. Then our attention began to change, and we began to focus on this. To make a long story short, the warlords who ran people's lives through tyranny, brutalizing, raping, maiming, killing, and whatnot, for almost a decade and a half, were chased out of town in Mogadishu in 2006 by a group called the Union of the Islamic Hordes. This was a ramshackle of a group of Islamic people who were not warlords themselves, who were not fanatics themselves, who were not radicals themselves, but who were pained by the plight of their people. And so once they chased the warlords out of town, the country became peaceful all over again without any intervention from outside. Unfortunately, Junior President George W. Bush was convinced by the Ethiopian government that this Union of the Islamic Hordes were a cover for terrorists. And it's that which then began what we see today as the tyranny of Al-Shabaab, both in Somalia and in Kenya, which led to the massacre in Garissa 3 weeks ago, where 145 students in a university were massacred by warlords, by terrorists.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I definitely want to get back to that in just a minute, but if we could rewind just a little bit there. I've read before, but is it right that preceding the creation of the Islamic Courts Union, that really, right after September 11th, at least in 2002, 2003, that the Americans started paying off the warlords who were, including Adid's son, the bad guy from the Black Hawk Down episode, and hiring these secularist-seeming warlords as long as they were promising to hunt down Islamists for us. And that was what really led to the solidification of the Islamic Courts Union against the warlords in the first place. Like, I think the way I learned it was, as you said, that the locals had diminished the power of the warlords already. But then when the Americans came and started backing the warlords, that was when the real fight broke out, and that was really what led to the creation of the ICU in the first place against the warlords. And then that became the excuse for the next intervention. Oh, no, now we got to get rid of the Islamic Courts Union. Is that correct?
I think that's an excellent reading of what transpired.
All right, good. Well, I'm glad we're straight on that. So yeah. Then when the Ethiopian, so then it's Christmas 2006. Take us to what happened then.
Well, then our government tacitly gave the green light for the Ethiopians to move in against the Union of the Islamic Courts, which they did with logistical support from Britain and the United States, particularly satellite imagery of where troops, Somali troops were at. Ethiopians captured Mogadishu, displaced about 1 million people in 2000, from December 2006 through 2008, bombed Mogadishu like there was no tomorrow and destroyed much of whatever little infrastructure of the country existed at that point in time. And then the Union of the Islamic Courts dispersed, and Somali people began to support the resistance movement against the Ethiopians. and the toughest group in that resistance movement, what was then called the youth wing of the Union of the Islamic Courts, or what we know today as Al-Shabaab. And the Somalis supported Al-Shabaab because they were the only ones who could stand up against the Ethiopians and ultimately push them out of the country.
So in other words, Al-Shabaab is basically, in reality, what the Americans pretended to be fighting when they hired the Ethiopians to invade in 06. Is that right?
That's correct. But Al-Shabaab was not a terrorist organization from our vantage point when the Ethiopians invaded. And we designated Al-Shabaab as a terrorist organization in the spring of 2008. And what they originally were fighting was to get rid of the Ethiopians in their country.
And how long was it before they declared their allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri or Bin Laden?
I think it was about, you know, just about that time. They did that declaration just before we declared them as a terrorist organization.
But after the invasion by the Ethiopians?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There was no affiliation as far as we can tell. In fact, the young man who was the head of the Al-Shabaab, although he was trained in Afghanistan, he had no religious training whatsoever and made no claims about that. I personally met him when I was in Mogadishu in 2006, and I was astonished by his sort of a lack of knowledge about Islam itself.
Mm-hmm. And then isn't it the case that after they, oh man, you know what, we don't have time for this. We'll get back to this on the other side of the break because it's too big of a question to ask there. But I guess here's what we could talk about. Would be the fact that they seem like, you know, they were smeared as being, if not Al-Qaeda, at least the Taliban, because they were closing movie theaters and stuff like that. But it seemed like they didn't even have the amount of power required to be a truly authoritarian government, the ICU, before the invasion, I mean.
I think that you are right. I think they were sufficient enough to chase the warlords and liberate the population from the terror of the warlords. Over time, they could very well have become sort of an authoritarian regime. Mm. But Ethiopia is an authoritarian regime, and we are able to provide them with military and material support. Sure. The question is not whether it's an authoritarian
or
not.
I'm sorry, we got to stop. We'll be right back, everybody. It's
okay.
Abdi Samatar, aljazeera.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Abdi Samatar. He's a professor at the University of Minnesota. He wrote this thing for aljazeera.com, The Nairobi Massacre and the Genealogy of the Tragedy. Of course, it's the American Empire's fault. The strongest power in the history of the world, picking on the weakest, smallest, little helpless, most helpless country in the history of the world here, basically. What it seems to shake out to. Now, I'm sorry, at the point we were interrupted at the break, you were saying, yeah, you know, they didn't have the Islamic Courts Union that Bush intervened to overthrow in 06. They didn't have enough actual raw power to enforce any kind of authoritarianism. They might have been some kind of Taliban light if they had even had the opportunity to be, but they never really had the strength to even be that. And then I think you were in the middle of saying when I interrupted you, sorry about that, something along the lines of, even if they were, then what? Talk, right? Instead of bombing them?
Yeah, so, I mean, the Ethiopians bombed them, and then our government, with the help of the Europeans, installed a new regime, a new government, a new president in Mogadishu. The head of that government was the former leader of the Union of the Islamic Courts, who have now become a tent coat, going against his old comrades, if you like. And then Al-Shabaab then went literally belly up and went crazy and began to do the kind of stuff that we now associate with them, suicide bombings, attacking people, civilians, and others alike. And then so we had a hand in the, if you like, in the making of what we know today as the terrorist group Al-Shabaab, which has killed those students, which firebombed the shopping mall, Westgate in Nairobi, has done numerous other things in Uganda and so on and so forth. What this all of this tell us that if we are not deliberate enough and thoughtful enough about our strategy in that part of the world or any part of the world, and are very serious about accountability and democratic governance by the local populations, this is the sort of thing that will be the sort of will come back at us and haunt us, to the point where Al-Shabaab has been recruiting from Minnesota, we are told. ISIS is recruiting from Minnesota, we are told. But we have to know, rather than just engaging in a firefight, how is our policy? Is our policy intelligent enough to ensure that there is a win-win situation for the local people and for our interests? Well, there is no such a win-win situation, then you will have people like Al-Shabaab and ISIS and others.
Well, how strong is Al-Shabaab now? Because we're skipping ahead quite a few years here. But
no, Al-Shabaab has been sort of forced out of all the major towns and cities in Somalia. But they can almost hit anywhere at their own choice and at their time. So they can become lethal in the sense of going into a university, rounding up the students, and then brutally massacring them. They can sort of walk into a shopping mall and do the same sort of thing.
Well, what if all the foreign troops under the African Union, are the Burundians and the Ethiopians, and I know in your article you say the Kenyans are still there. Are they all still there? And then what if they left?
They are all still there, and we, the American government and the European Union, provide resources and support them fully to the tune of several hundred million dollars a year. Mm-hmm. We pay very little attention to Somali security forces. And my sort of a basic understanding is that we can train and mobilize 20,000 Somali security forces at fraction of the cost that the African Union force costs today to our taxpayers, and still get a much more effective security force that's accountable to its people, Somalis that is, and that will literally drive Al-Shabaab to the sea. Mm. We are not doing that, and the recent visit by our Secretary of State, Mr. Kerry, to Somalia was a window dressing to a problem that nobody seems to want to address.
Now, I mean, is there actually a chance that the government that's been created by the Americans and their cohorts to rule Somalia, the quote-unquote government, that same state could, you know, end up healing the rifts and representing the people, as you say? Or, you know, maybe a better solution would be for America and its puppet powers to just back off and let the Somalis work it out themselves rather than
help them figure it out. Well, I think Somalis will need help from outside world. But the kind of help they need has to be genuine help. And Somalis, there are a large number of Somalis in the United States who are happy here. Somalis see questions of democracy and development as something they are deeply committed and interested in. So they were going to need help to recover from this war. But the regime in Mogadishu is as corrupt as you can get. Transparency International ranked them number one in the world as the most corrupt regime in the world.
Wow.
You can't expect that kind of a regime to deliver goods and services and leadership for its own population. We have to move this one out and help Somalis select and elect a government that reflects their hopes and dreams. The day we do something to that effect, and the Somalis will have to walk the talk themselves, then I think we can find partners in that part of the world who respect themselves and respect their people and who are willing to legitimately work with the international community on a mutual basis rather than subservient basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, very importantly, you write in your article that the Kenyan forces, and particularly in the town of Kismayo, on the shore there, that they're really creating their own little fiefdom there with their own warlord that they're supporting, and they refuse to work with the government of Mogadishu. Sounds like there might be a lot of good reason why they wouldn't want to work with the government of Mogadishu, but it doesn't sound like it's the good reasons are the reasons why that they won't. It sounds like they're breaking off their own little mini state.
That's correct. The Ethiopians are doing the same thing elsewhere. Kenya is one of the most corrupt states in the African continent. And Nigeria leads that score after Somalia, but Kenya is high on the rank of some of the most corrupt regimes in the world by Transparency International. they are not interested in helping Somalis put their Humpty Dumpty back together. They are interested to use that region, which they occupy now, as a buffer zone, but as also as a wedge to influence what becomes of Somalia in the future. This is what the Somali people completely reject and don't like. And Al-Shabaab is using that as a pretext for its doing its own cruel deeds.
Right. Yeah, war's the health of fighters everywhere, I guess. All right. Well, listen, we're all out of time. I'm actually keeping a little bit over time here, but thanks very much for coming on the show. It's great to talk to you.
With pleasure, sir.
All right, y'all.
Thank you.
Everybody, that is Abdi Samatar. He is a professor of geography at the University of Minnesota and a research fellow at the University of Pretoria and a member of the African Academy of Sciences. You can find him here at aljazeera.com, The Nairobi Massacre and the Genealogy of the Tragedy. Oh, man, and I'm 30 seconds ahead here. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Spacing out. You know what? I always like to take opportunity like this when I'm screwing up to recommend that you look at page 222 of Jeremy Scahill's book, Dirty Wars, where, as remember he said, the guy turned coat and went with the Americans. The plan was to do that all along, to keep the guy they were overthrowing all along, but just to get tens of thousands of people killed in the process, really hundreds of thousands when you count the famine that came later, the creation of this terrorist group, Shabaab. Hey, Al Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
No, that's not good. Jack Keane is on Fox News claiming that the Russian-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine are launching an offensive and breaking the ceasefire. I guess we'll find out the truth of that later. We go to Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute and Forbes magazine, Forbes.com. Sailing and sinking. The RMS Lusitania, a century of lying America into war. Man, Doug, you get away with writing some pretty brave stuff in Forbes. I sure like that. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, man?
Doing okay. How about yourself?
Real good. So it's 100 years ago today, is that right?
That's it.
All right, tell them the story. What happened?
Down it went.
And how many souls aboard?
Oh, there were about 1,200 died. You know, about 100, I think 128 were American. You know, mostly British, but, you know, a smattering of others. But, of course, you know, what the U.S. cares about mostly is its own.
Of course. That's what
created the controversy in the U.S.
All right, so tell us the story and assume that some people really don't know anything about World War One for a minute.
Well, yeah, World War One gets going. You have two competing imperial blocs, and neither of which, frankly, had a lot to say for itself. And the U.S. was officially neutral, and no surprise, you know, the Brits used their navy and want to starve the Germans into submission. The Germans don't have a big navy. They rely on U-boats or submarines. And it's a new form of warfare. And the British basically played games where if you surface the sub to see if there are innocent people on board, you know, they'll ram the sub or shoot at it if they had guns on. A lot of these liners were reserve cruisers. So the Germans simply said, fine, we just sink them. Down they go. And Lusitania was a very famous one that went down in May of 1915. You know, it was a passenger liner, but they had millions of cartridges on board and probably other explosives which weren't, declared. So what you do is you have a ship of a belligerent power traveling through a war zone filled with munitions, and, no surprise, the Germans sunk it. You know, and Wilson in the U.S. said you can't do that. Even one American on board, you have to let it sail through. So it became one of the causes for war when the U.S. got involved a couple of years later, the whole question about U-boats and whether Americans should be exempt from, you know, from the shooting.
Mm-hmm. And now, I think you write in the article that all the passengers knew that the way I had learned it was all their warnings were only in the papers in the Midwest, nowhere near the dock, but that all the local papers had the ad warning them not to get on board were pulled. But is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you can see, I mean, actually, you can go back historically and find there's a Cunard line ad for the Titanic, the Lusitania leaving on May 1st, and underneath is the German warning. And, of course, look, if you're a smart person, you realize there's a war going on. I mean, there were passengers who asked, kind of the British, were a little nervous about this, and they said, oh, don't worry, the ship can outrun the U-boats. Well, that's true, except if the U-boat's already there, you can't outrun it. Yeah, so there were passengers who were aware of it and were nervous about it. I mean, this is commonly understood. Ships were being sunk, so the notion you could kind of book passage on a British ship and assume you can just float across the Atlantic and not worry about anything was crazy.
But it was no secret that it was full of arms at the time as well?
Well, actually, the manifest did not hide the fact it had the cartridges on. Now, there was a lot of supposition it had other stuff that was not declared. But that was actually openly declared, so that was known. Now, a passenger might not know that. That is, if you're booking passage, you're probably not asking what else is going in the hold. But in terms of the official manifest, it was available, kind of through the government channels. It was on it.
All right. Now, so what about the British Navy? I mean, you don't seem very shy about pointing your finger at Winston Churchill here.
Well, this is one of those where, good old Winston, look, I mean, if I was the first Lord of the Admiralty, my job would be to get America in on America's side. I mean, I'd look at it on Britain's side. What he was doing was in Britain's interest. I mean, if you were at war, you'd love to get the big neutral power in. I mean, a week beforehand, he wrote to the head of the Board of Trade saying it's important to draw neutral shipping to our shores, in an attempt to try to embroil America with Germany. And the Royal Navy, had destroyers nearby. It was sunk just a few miles off of Ireland, so it was actually approaching the British Isles. They knew U-boats were in the vicinity. They had destroyers close by. They didn't send anything out. Now, that doesn't mean they wanted it to sink, but at the very least, they were pretty careless. That, if they actually cared about, safeguarding a ship like this, they made no effort to do so.
All right. And then, so how badly did they exploit it? I guess when I learned about this when I was a kid, I was thinking that this was what led to the declaration of war. I didn't really realize, oh, no, it was still another couple of years before they finally got us into the war. But just how bad was this exploited by the Democrats at the time?
Well, the British were really upset because they thought this should bring us in. I mean, they were quite happy. Colonel House, who was Woodrow Wilson's, kind of close confidant, was in London at the time, and they were all complaining, why doesn't this bring you in? They had a brilliant propaganda operation in the United States. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. I mean, they were headquartered there. They put out lots of lies, atrocity stories. They had very good connections, especially with the East Coast and financial centers.
You think House was in on it?
Very much. They used it in Britain as well. I have actually a poster from the war that's British that's wonderfully done. I mean, it shows the ocean and heads bobbing in the ocean. It has Britannia stepping across the ocean with a sword saying, pick up the sword of justice. I mean, they were brilliant in terms of knowing how to play to emotions. So they used it for all they could.
You think House was in on it? The luring of the Lusitania into dangerous waters and such?
Oh, I tend not to be a conspiracy kind of guy. I mean, I look at this thinking, this was fairly normal passage. And I think that kind of the Churchill view is the more of this stuff we get coming, the more likely something is to get sunk, and that will help us. It wasn't, let's bring in a particular ship, and boy, we can get it sunk. I mean, I think this is one they just kind of thought nature would take its course. Yeah. Quite callous. Not quite the same as plotting it, but still pretty callous.
I see what you mean. I can't help myself when it comes to House, though.
He and Woodrow Wilson are quite scummy. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, I think, is in perhaps the worst president we've ever had in so many ways. So certainly House, plays a role in that. But I think that, again, he's one. He thought, we should go to war over something like this. But I don't think that he was actively kind of plotting. I don't think the British really trusted him. I mean, they would look at him as somebody who might be an ally, but, would you trust Colonel House? I mean, I wouldn't.
Yeah, no, I don't know how anybody could, even Wilson.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, and now, tell us about the Zimmerman telegram, then.
Oh, yeah, the Zimmerman telegram, got everyone all upset. I mean, the Germans, the tragedy here, all the sides bear a lot of blame. I mean, I'm no, fan of the Kaiser and all his crew. I mean, these weren't very nice guys. Yeah, but they were just utterly stupid when it came to diplomacy. So as you're getting closer to what it looks like war might be coming, what the Germans did is quite sensible in the sense they approached the Mexicans. They kind of sent a famous telegram to their ambassador and kind of, here's a potential deal. If we end up at war with America, Mexico should join us, and then if we all win, Mexico gets the territory back that the U.S. stole back in the 1840s. I mean, the U.S. took roughly half of Mexico. I mean, California, Texas. I mean, a lot of the territory the Mexicans viewed as theirs, and America grabbed it. You know, so when it was released, I mean, it created a firestorm in the United States, and it helped push popular opinion in 1970 towards war. But the Germans were really just saying, look, I mean, if we end up at war with America, why shouldn't we find allies? You know, America, if it comes to war with us, is going to join the other guys as allies. So in that sense, it was fairly standard politics. But boy, politically, it was a really dumb thing to do.
Yeah, except that it didn't matter that that was completely laughable and ridiculous, that Germany way over there that can't even sail a boat out of their own harbor is going to somehow help Mexico take back the southwest of the United States.
And the fact that Mexico had no, I mean, the Mexicans got waxed when they went to war before. Mexico was in no better position to take on America in 1914.
Wilson himself had already invaded Mexico twice.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the point is so much of this stuff is symbolism.
But
I mean,
that was the proximate casus belli, though. He took that and took it to Congress for the declaration of war.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he understood how to, I mean, the stories of when he spoke to Congress, a congressman weeping, you know, the audience just being moved by his rhetoric. You know, I mean, you look back and think how horrific this is. But he was quite an orator at the time. So he knew how to play all this stuff. And the Zimmerman telegram goes into that.
Yep. All right. Hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Doug Bandow from Forbes and Cato about the worst person who ever existed, Woodrow Wilson, and the horrible things that he did to everyone. Right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Doug Bandow from Forbes and Cato. His article at Forbes is called Sailing and Sinking the RMS Lusitania, A Century of Lying America into War. And so then this is the whole thing. Now, I heard one time, I forgot who it was, somebody saying on the radio that it's so easy to tell the story of World War II to a little kid. Never mind the Soviet Union, but there were some bad guys in the Nazis and the Japanese imperialists and us and the other good guys, the British and, you know, sometimes the French, teamed up to beat them for the good guys and democracy and freedom and all that kind of thing. It's really hard to explain World War One to a little kid because there's not a simple cut and dry black and white narrative like us good, enemies bad, that kind of thing. And the problem with that is, to me, is that World War One is the one that's packed full of so many lessons about, first of all, as Eric Margolies is always trying to harp on this show about how humongous, horrifying, terrible wars can start accidentally. They really can. And don't go messing around because you could trip a wire that you're not even really, you know, thinking about. But then also in all of just the decades of consequences that our so-called leaders have basically chased down the timeline ever since then, trying to correct the catastrophes left in their wake from last time. And it seems like American entry and breaking the stalemate in World War One was the real original sin of the 20th century. Not even World War One itself, but American entry into it is what ruined the rest. What do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, that war, to me, I mean, that war really explains the rest. That, you know, World War II is the unfinished business of World War One. That, you know, in World War II, there were a couple of really, really horrific opponents in a way that World War One just had a lot of idiots, in a sense. I mean, that, you know, most of the folks who fought in World War One, these are probably aren't people I'd want to sit down at dinner with, you know, whether it be the Kaiser or the Tsar. Nevertheless, you know, these were not the kind of moral monsters of an Adolf Hitler. And, you know, them going to war was tragic and stupid, but you could imagine the outcome of that being something, you know, more of a compromise and worked out. The U.S. is what completely unbalanced that. And I think then that's what got us into World War II, is you have this utterly unbalanced outcome, and so much comes out of that, that, and you know, Woodrow Wilson got into this not with any kind of a sense of rationality or reason, but it's this kind of megalomaniac, I'm going to reorder the world, I'm going to end war, you know, and you come up with, frankly, that kind of nutty stuff. I mean, you just imagine how badly it's going to turn out, and that's exactly the way it turned out.
Yeah, it really was like the public choice theory or whatever, where he's running down the street in his cape, prancing and strutting and acting, basically. A player on the world stage. Look at me, everyone.
Exactly. Now, I'm believing that if, you know, if only I can kind of redo all this stuff, everything will be wonderful. You know, and frankly, and what that does is that encourages, you know, I mean, him to do the dumbest things. And he, you know, America had to get into the war for him to be able to do this. So, I mean, he was never really this peacenik who was reluctant, oh, I don't want to get in. I mean, this is a guy who understood his agenda required the U.S. being a combatant.
Yeah. Even though he ran on the slogan, he kept us out of war. Now, so what were the politics then in 1916? Were people really buying that? Like, geez, at least he's not TR in them, right?
Well, that's what I mean. The problem is what you had at that time was the great mass of Americans had absolutely no interest in this war. You had a fairly small number of folks who were very much Anglophiles. You know, look, if you were a bank that had lent money to Great Britain, you sure wanted it to win. You know, if you're one of the munitions makers, you know, who's supplying them and getting stuff on credit and whatnot, you know, you want them to win. You know, the point is they had a fairly active and influential base of people who really wanted this, but the broad mass of people had no interest. So, you know, they really wanted the peace candidate. I mean, the idea of getting involved in this lunacy overseas, you look and say, and for what? You know, that for most Americans, I mean, there was no reason at all to get involved.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's interesting because I think, you know, I learned even in government school, probably in junior high or something, about the Treaty of Versailles and not so much about the territory stripped away, but at least about all the war reparations and how unfair it all seems, some of the hyperinflation maybe, that kind of thing. And so, and then I guess later on I learned about how the rise of the Soviet Union also took, you know, had something to do with this, since even after the Tsar was overthrown, the interim government stayed in the war. And if only they had gotten out of the war in time, they could have prevented the creation of the USSR and the coup by Lenin and Trotsky and all that. But then what I never learned until much later, I guess, in context, was what this all meant in the Middle East as the Ottoman Empire was destroyed and the British and the French, but mostly the British got it all, and all the chain of consequences that we're still dealing with from that.
Yeah, it's all the line drawing. I mean, they had these empires that, you know, were not places we'd probably want to live, but which were not totalitarian horror shows that we saw so often after that. Well, the Ottoman Empire was one, Austro-Hungarian, Russian, all these things fall apart. And then, I mean, you know, so the Brits go in, and the whole, you know, Sykes-Picot, you know, that you just draw lines. And the lines have nothing to do with tribes or with peoples or language. You just kind of draw them around and, you know, let's create Iraq, let's create Kuwait, or let's put Syria here. And then you just kind of put this, now who's going to be ruler? Well, these are our friends. Why don't we put the Hashemites here? Well, I mean, this just set up, you know, potentially centuries of disaster. I mean, we're dealing into the decades of creating instability of, you know, peoples. You know, I mean, Iraq is a country that would never be a country normally, but it was line drawing. And World War I gave us that. It gave us that in the Balkans as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know what? Let me ask you this. You've been at this a long time. What is the real American interest over there anyway? Because, you know, I know there was a Cato study. I presume you probably wrote it back in the mid-1990s, saying, and that was way before the terror war, right? That was just back then, as horrible as it already was, saying we spend, I forgot how many times, more, quote-unquote, securing Middle Eastern oil than we spend on Middle Eastern oil. It's completely ridiculous. Certainly not in America's national interest.
You know, David Henderson, a naval postgraduate school, has done some fabulous writing on this. I mean, he writes for Anti-War. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he's looked at this. I mean, the point is, it's an international marketplace for energy. Even bad guys in control of oil want to sell it. I mean, you know, the royals in Saudi Arabia wouldn't survive a day if they didn't have money to hand out. So the point is, you know, the notion that, you know, the oil would cease if we weren't over there is silly. You know, and especially today, I mean, you're having discoveries all over. I mean, U.S. with shale oil and stuff. You know, there's certainly a sense in which you prefer that region not to be aflame. You know, with the Suez Canal, there is transit of some stuff beyond oil. You know, but the notion that somehow the entire world is, you know, kind of our future is determined by the Middle East, It's just not true. And it's always been unstable. I mean, this, you know, we've had, you know, sales and commerce going on despite the fact it's been unstable. So the notion that we have to be over there and can stabilize it, I mean, we just make it even less stable. We have, you know, new wars and bombings and intervention. I mean, backing the Saudis in Yemen. I mean, this is crazy stuff.
Yeah, well, especially the latter there. Now, so how widespread is the sort of little bit of kind of the most minor form of acknowledgement of this problem in D.C. where people, do they at least say to each other that, you know, we are kind of bad at this, at least, even if they still pretend they mean well, or what is it?
Well, it's almost all partisan. That is, you know, the guys we don't like, the guys in power obviously are bad at this. But if we were in charge, yeah, everything would be wonderful.
Yeah, never mind a few years back when our guys made it this way.
No, I mean, all the Bush people blame Obama because Obama followed the Bush policy on withdrawing from Iraq, so obviously everything's Obama's fault, even though Bush is the guy who invaded. Yeah. I mean, they forget the invasion. That kind of just disappears into distant history. Oh, it's all Obama's fault. And you kind of sit there and marvel at this. Of, you know, I mean, you know, and all these people wanted the Libya thing, and it's a disaster. And, well, that was a long time ago, you know. I mean, it's very, very, it's all partisan. It's all the other guy.
Yeah. Well, and now, so, I mean, that's the whole thing of it. I guess we skipped ahead here to America inheriting the British Empire and the way we administer it now. But I guess I just wonder whether you think we're within decades of the American establishment kind of overall snapping out of it and deciding to just give this up, at least dictating that part of the world's future.
No, I think what has to happen is the American people just have to indicate they're fed up. That, you know, there has to be a point where, you know, we need candidates. I mean, we have a bit of that with Rand Paul. I mean, kind of a little back and forth. I mean, there's, you know, Jim Webb. I mean, there's a little bit there of people who are more, you know, skeptical. We need a couple of very strong candidates who will put this at the forefront. They won't hide it. And are going to lead against the others and will point the finger and say, it's the other folks who have created these problems. Don't listen to them. Finally. I mean, don't listen to a Bush or to a Clinton or to all these other folks. You know, they've all been in favor of all of this stuff. Rubio, the whole lot of them.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, as you often do, it's very important that people, you know, attack these policies from the right. For how radical they truly are.
Exactly.
And really kind of outflank these crazies in the, who frankly mostly are so-called moderates in the center, who are the most extreme.
Exactly.
Anyway, great work as always, Doug. You're the best. Thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Take care now.
All right, y'all. That's Doug Bandow. He's at Forbes.com. Read him on the Lusitania. Today's 100th anniversary. Thanks for listening. See y'all tomorrow.